Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Chatting with Sherry is sponsored by Atelier Lacine, a fusion of culture of classic lines with contemporary feel in the vision behind the unique pearl jewelry design. Today we have a special broadcast. I'm very excited to welcome back TJ Scott. He's a wonderful director. He's done such shows as Xena, Gotham, Bitten, and he's got a new show called Dark Matter. Welcome, TJ.
Thank you so much. Nice to be here.
Hi, how you doing?
Excellent, excellent. Good.
Well, today we're going to talk about a lot of different subjects, but there a lot of Xena fans are in the audience. So, you know, one of my first questions will be about Xena. When you started with directing the Xena episodes, did you know yet that it was popular, or was it before it became popular?
When I started on Xena, I did one of the very first episodes, and I was around the show a lot because I was doing Hercules at the time, which was the other partner show to it, and we had no idea. We made it for no money at all. It was like zero budget to start with. And we used to call it the little show, and then soon it became the big show. So we had no idea at the beginning that it was going to do what it, the sort of business that it did at all.
I've noticed that about shows sometimes, like the ones that have the smallest budget but the biggest heart seems to like explode. Is that something you've noticed while being a director, or is that just my imagination?
You just never know. I mean, shows like Orphan Black started out really small too, you know, very tight budgets and stuff, and then that exploded. So you don't know. Some of them just fall off the map and you never hear them again. But I knew Xena had the right ingredients from day one, and I kind of really felt that. So I was very into it, you know, right from the beginning as a director, and really wanted to be on it to try and create something special because I felt it was there.
It was a remarkable show. I had a request from one of your fans. They are a fan of Spartacus, and they wanted to find out how you felt about working with Andy.
I actually never worked with Andy.
He
was only there in, obviously, for season one before he became sick. We're talking about Andy Whitfield. And I loved watching the show. I had been asked to direct it the first season. I was tied up. I couldn't do an episode. And so I really regret not being able to work with him because he left such a legacy behind. And then I happened to be on set directing an episode when he passed away, and we had to tell the whole cast and crew that he had passed away. And it was such an emotional day. I felt like I knew him, even though I never worked with him.
Ugh. That must have been horrible. Were you the one who had to tell the cast?
No, but we wanted to, the producers came to me and sort of whispered in my ear about 10 o'clock in the morning that he had passed away. And I knew he was sick, but they hadn't really, you know, that he was like on his, you know, very sick. But they hadn't really told everybody that. He was kind of hiding it a little bit. He just didn't want, you know, everyone calling. And so the producers came to me on set and said, look, we have to gather everyone and tell them before they hear on the internet. So we got the first unit and the second unit, which is about 400 people together, and the producers told them. And then we tried to go back to work, and it was like everyone was just in such a fog. We just went, oh, screw this. Let everybody go home. We'll start again tomorrow. We'll catch up. So
yeah.
It was sad.
That must have been devastating. That's horrible. And this is totally in a different direction, but I'm just going by my list of questions. One of the questions that I have is, how do you select what you're going to direct? Do you get hired? Do you request it? How does the process work on how you get the projects you get?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you hope that the phone rings, that they call your agent and ask you to do shows. But occasionally I will chase a show. So sometimes I get a call saying, is this a show that's something you might be interested in? And I kind of tend to know what shows I want to do, you know, right away. They need to be a little dark, a little edgy. But sometimes like a show like Longmire, I actually really loved the show. I saw it, so I went chasing it and said, can you get me an interview with the producers? I'd actually like to go in and pitch what I'd like to do for the show. And they set up a meeting, and I ended up getting it by going in and doing essentially an audition. And really, directors do audition. You have to go into the room and do a little song and dance, even on the shows that you know, one of the producers might want you on. You have to go sell yourself to the network. So it,
wow.
it's a funny process. You're auditioning a little bit like an actor in a way. They want to see really that you don't have two heads.
I had no idea that directors had auditions. I just thought they would look at the clips from your work and say, oh, okay, this is the guy who has our style. I didn't know you'd had to go there and sell yourself like actors.
It can go that way too, but they're, you know, they look at your stuff and they think they want to work with you, but then they also want to make sure that, you know, you're going to spend 3 weeks or 6 weeks together. They want to make sure that you're a guy that they like to work with.
Oh, so it's like a personality thing.
A little bit, yeah. Yeah, so I say, you know, it's like they want to make sure you don't have two heads, that you're not like this one creative person on one end and an idiot on the other end. So it is a bit of a personality test.
Interesting. That opens some that windows into that private process of creating a show. Because none of us know that stuff.
Well, the other thing too, Sherry, is there's often, you know, a creative force. There might be three producers on a show, and you've worked with one of them before, but not the other two. So everybody's bringing, you know, their directors that they like to the table, and they have to sort out which ones they're going to sit down and have a meal with. So quite often you're brought in, you're one person's guy, and then it's like, but meet the others and see if you can convince them to let you sit at the table with them too.
Wow. That's
which is what happened with the Dark Matter pilot. I was brought in because I had worked for one of the executive producers and then never met the other two. So I had to go in and do my little fun and dance.
And could you we're still early into the show, but tell us a little bit about Dark Matter. I know it's brand new. I know the pilot's just come out, and I know you're excited about it. So tell us a little bit about it.
It's a really fun new sci-fi project that Sci-Fi Network is airing pretty much around the world, though Space Channel has it in Canada. And it's a space opera, and it comes from two of the writers that were on Stargate. For almost all of Stargate, Joe Malozzi and Paul Muehle. And they wrote a script, and then the script didn't go right away, so they turned it into a graphic novel that was rather popular. And then they took the graphic novel out and with the script and then sold it. And we shot the pilot, I guess, about 6 months ago in Toronto, and it went right to series. And it just started airing last night on Sci-Fi, and you can catch it there on reruns. And it's very fun. It's like they like to say, we wanted to put the keep it dark, but put the fun back in sci-fi. A lot of the shows, you know, have gone very moody and dark.
Very, very, you know, dark, yeah.
And this one's kind of got a darkness, but it's got, you know, it's got some tongue-in-cheek, some fun, old-school, good laughs in it and stuff. And so it was super fun to direct.
And how many episodes did you direct of it, or is it just the pilot?
I directed the pilot and then episode two, and I kind of, they already knew it was going to series because it had been sold around the world. And we kind of shot the two of them in tandem. We cross-boarded the episode one and two. And there's 13 episodes that have been shot, and it'll play out over the next few weeks. And I hope people tune into it. I think so. I think everybody will really like it if you're into sci-fi at all, because it hits on all the notes. It's operatic. It's got tension. It's got some action. It's got humor. It's got good-looking people. It's got fun storylines, good twists. It's very smart. And the writers had really thought it out. Paul and Joe had the 13 episodes written when we started the pilot, which was fantastic. Like, they knew exactly where all the characters were going. They had it super plotted out, which is, you know, so paramount to making a great series.
That makes it easier on everybody, right? Not just the writing and directors, but the actors know where they're going with their characters.
Oh, it was so cool because Paul and Joe would be around set, and one of the actors would go, What's this line here? And they go, oh, that's, it plays in, you're leading up to something you're going to discover in episode 4. And then it's going to come out, and we're going to re-reveal that in episode 8. And I go, oh, okay, cool. Now I know, you know, how to deliver it, which was great to have them on set to be able to do that, and great to have it so thought out that it wasn't just like a one-off episode. It was really setting things up for a whole season.
That is so cool. I haven't seen it yet. I wasn't home to watch it, so I'm going to watch it tonight. I'm looking forward to it.
I watched it at 3 in the morning last night.
You watched it 3 in the morning?
I had friends over till late. That's when I could put it on. So it's just fun to see it
on
TV.
Did you watch
it
with your friends at 3 o'clock in the morning?
No, I watched it by myself at 3. There's always a thing, as a director, you've seen your final cut, you've probably seen the producer's cut, but on a show where there's lots of visual effects and stuff, it's never until the last minute that they're all in there. So really what I was seeing was the VFX and the score and the final color timing were the new things for me. I knew what the cut was of it.
That's a question I have. I mean, I know that a director for a TV series is like an actor, or and a lot of writers too, is that they're hired. You know, they're not for the whole series. Are you aware of what's going on with the score? Do you consult with the people who, because the music and the tension is very important? Do you consult with them at all, or do they consult with you, or how does that work?
Shows are really different, and it really depends. Quite a few, what the traditional thing that happens is that an editor will put in a temp score, and the temp score will be something that everyone has agreed is the feel of it. So a simple example would be like on Gotham, we would use a temp score that came from the Dark Knight movies, you know, because that suits it. And then as the composer builds up a library of stuff that he's built for the show, you can temp in stuff that's by the composer. A show that's really unique is Longmire, where we send the editor's cut to the composer, David Shepherd, and he puts in a score. He actually sits there and does a little score to it. And then it comes back, and when the director does his cut, he puts a little score in. And then when the producers do a cut, he rescores the whole thing, which that's the first time ever worked like that. But it's brilliant because you're not guessing, you know, where the right notes would be. Plus, he knows exactly where to put the music in at the right times. So that's the first time I've ever done that, but it's awesome. Fun, different way to do it. I would advocate it for a show that supports it.
What a talented man.
Mm-hmm.
Is that he can do that over and over again, score it and score it and score it. I mean, wow.
And what he says is that he keeps re-looking at the thing and going, oh, I could do that better, I could do that better, whereas normally when you do a show, you've done it once, and then you look at it, you know, when it finally comes up and says, oh, I could have added that. By that point, he's added in all his little flourishes and changes and, you know, rewatched it enough times. So it's very cool.
That is. Wow. That's really neat. So when you work on different projects, do you I don't know, like in the old days with actors, young Natalie Wood would be in The Ghost of Mrs. Muir and Miracle on 34th Street, and I forgot the third one, all at the same time, and have three different accents. I mean, how do you jump from project to project? Do you do it, can you be working on two different projects, popping back and forth within days, or do you separate them? How does that work?
theory, you should have a little separation. Five shows in a row that just all tip and tail overlapped. And that doesn't happen a lot. It's just the way the schedule fell in. Still overlapped for a couple of days, just in prep, probably. You're off shooting while you should be prepping. But on the beginning of Dark Matter, I really overlapped a lot, and that overlapped with both The Strain and the season finale for Bitten. And I was shooting the season finale of Bitten, and they had to move the last 4 days of the show into night shooting so that I could prep The Strain in the day and then go and shoot Bitten season finale at night. So for 4 days, I went back and forth, back and forth, back and forth between the two shows. But I don't advocate that, and it doesn't happen a lot.
But how do you do that? I mean, because they're totally different shows. How do you get yourself in the mindset, and then you have to pop out of that mindset and go into the other mindset? Isn't that difficult?
I really enjoy it. It is difficult, but that's
creative.
It's very fun for me to try and, you know, think out the different shows and, you know, how each show is shot and what the sets are. And so I really try and focus in on what I call is, what's this show's thing? What's their thing? Like on Orphan Black, the thing is minutia. It's all about making it as much about the characters as possible and never missing an acting. Gotham, mm-hmm. part of the thing is making it big. So when you're scouting locations, it's like, okay, this needs to be big. What's the big shot of Gotham? What's the setting? What's, you know, so as long as you think of what the thing is about each show as you're going along, it seems to work. And Dark Matter was almost all in sets. So it was interesting. A lot of the prep on that was like looking at sets and imagining how they were going to be in 2 weeks when they were actually finally built as you blocked it out.
That's something that I find fascinating, too, is that I know that TV has very, very difficult budgets, and yet they make stuff look so humongous. Is it the way you shoot it? I mean, is it the way the, you know, the costumes are, or is it the way the way it's shot through the camera? How is it that, you know, you guys have a shoestring budget, but it looks like you're shooting a movie?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, a lot of shows these days actually now have very large budgets. You know, Spartacus was a massive budget. Gotham is a really big budget. But then a show like Dark Matter, which was all, you know, in a spaceship, actually really did use a cinematic trick to it to make it look much larger than the sets. The sets were gorgeous, but they weren't huge, designed by Ian Brock. And so I did some in-camera tricks to make them look a lot bigger than they are. And each hallway stretch out longer just by lens choices, where the camera was, how you would shoot an entire set and then turn it around and make it look like it was an extension of the set, even though you were reusing the set, but just light it differently. So there are a lot of tricks in camera to make stuff look bigger. But a lot of it is lighting and lens choice and blocking of actors. And then sometimes you have huge sets like on Gotham.
There's such an art to lighting. When you're your director, lighting is so important. Is that something that is taught to you, or is that something that you just have a feel for?
Well, you've got a cinematographer who's, you know, a director of photography is his title. So, and they've normally got a bit of a vision or a very big vision of what they want the show to look like. I'm one of those directors who really loves lighting and loves the camera and everything. So I'll talk a lot about it, the lighting of each scene, the director of photography. But you can also be a director and give kind of very big notes to the director of photography. And he's been hired to be able to, you know, have the look for the show. So you don't really need to give them normally a lot of notes. I find that it really helps when you do, and the shows end up looking much better if your vision for the show is translated through them and it's a unified vision. But I love collaborating with cinematographers. It's one of my very favorite parts of the whole process.
Yeah, I was looking at some pictures of a series that I like, and they were all black and white stills done by the cinematographer, and it looked like it was obviously done on set, and he just made it black and white, but it looks like it was done back in the period of the show. I mean, it was just gorgeous. They're artists.
Mm-hmm. I love black and white, and I love reducing colors down on a set. I'll often take out, you know, a whole set of colors that are never in a show. I just did a Longmire episode where there's no blue in the entire episode, and just by reducing colors down, it just makes it more about light and performance and actors' eyes and stuff. I'd love to be able to shoot just in black and white, too, sometimes. It's fantastic. It just reduces everything down in a beautiful way.
Yeah, and it just makes it, like you said, it's the eyes. It makes them look brighter. It just, people who don't like black and white don't know what they're missing. It's I've had this argument with younger people so many times. I said, don't you realize that they've had the ability to do color since the 30s? People who do black and white movies choose to do it because of the look, and they don't get it.
Yeah. Yeah, I tend to put all my actors in black as much as I can, too, so it sort of go towards black and white feel to it. It frames people up nicely.
Yeah, and it just, black looks good.
It's, even if your wardrobe isn't expensive, it's in black, it looks great.
Yeah,
when you're talking about being on those low-budget shows, when they don't have a big budget, put them in black, it's going to look great.
White too, both of them. They just look good on human skin. It doesn't matter what your texture is. It black and white looks good.
White's always a tricky one on sets, and it used to be really tricky. Like, director of photography hate it because it kind of sets where the light needs to be. You're almost lighting around white so that it doesn't blow out too much or it doesn't look too dark. You know, you've already looked at your white, so. We tend to not to like white on actors, like maybe a little color and stuff, but it's kind of always been a taboo color to have, which is interesting.
It's interesting because it does look good.
It does. It's just so finite in how you have to light it. Black, you know, it can be black is black. White can turn yellow really easily if the lighting's not right, or it can turn blue and it can change from shot to shot, too. It kind of... it betrays your color temperature in a way on set.
I remember when I used to be an extra when I was very young, what they call it atmosphere now, and one of the things they said, don't bring white, don't bring plaid, don't bring stripes. Anything else you bring is fine, but don't bring those things. There's a whole list of stuff not to bring when you brought your wardrobe.
It was on my show's be. Bring black.
Yeah, bring black. No, black and red, you know, those colors they like, but they didn't want you to have plaid. They didn't want you to have stripes.
Yeah.
Nothing. The only one was an exception. It was funny because it was an accident. I was working on, I was going to tell you my age. I was working on a show called Silver Spoons way, way, way back.
Yeah.
And I had this plaid, really. It was blue and black. And I was wearing it. I wasn't going to bring it as wardrobe. I was just wearing it over the tank top that I had on. And I was carrying my stuff, and the girl who was doing, oh, that's perfect. Wear that. And I'm like, which one? No, what you're wearing. I go, but it's plaid.
Yeah.
But they like the... TJ, you broke up. TJ?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, I got you. Okay, you're back. No. What were you saying?
I was saying, did you work with Ricky Schroeder on Silver Spoons?
That's the show, yeah.
Did you work with him? Did you?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah, he was a sweet guy. We had a good...
Yeah.
He was really nice to us.
Oh, great. I did a movie with him a few years ago. was fun.
Yeah, we had a good time. Him and, oh God, why can't I? Alfonso. He played his best friend. I can't remember his name. Sorry.
Something like Ribeiro or something like that. Alfonso,
yeah,
Ribeiro.
Yeah, he was really sweet too. But they were kids and they would run around and they act like kids, you know. But they were really nice to the atmosphere people. They didn't have to be, but they were.
Oh, super. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah, that was one of my fun sets. Because I had, I was in college and I had met Erin Gray. She had given a symposium at my school. I went to Pierce College. And when I went on set, I was sure she wouldn't know who I was because it was, you know, there was 20 people in the class, and I was sure she did more. She came right over to me. Hi, you were in my class, weren't you?
Oh, that's great.
So it was great. I had a great time on that set.
Fantastic.
Yeah. But anyway, that's my boring life.
Silver Spoons.
I just met. Oh, it was fun. I mean, I did a lot of really fun shows back then. I mean, and it was easier when you were working back then because, I don't know, it's just, you went to the different agencies and you auditioned for the extra parts and you got it within 5 minutes and that was it and you were working. It's not like that anymore.
No, everything's on tape these days. We so auditioning is like watching people on tape. Nobody is in the room. I always try and say, look, we set up the room. I want to meet the actors, you know, that we're going to hire instead of just hiring them off of tapes. And everyone's like, oh, we don't do that. So I still petition as much as possible to get in the room because I like to know the people I'm working with.
Yeah.
Much more fun to see people in person than to watch their tapes late at night.
I mean, one of the most fun ones that I ever did, and I still love it, and I look back at great affection, was Golden Girls. I got to meet them all. And I was a specialty player, so I got to be on the set through rehearsal and everything. And that was like a dream. I worked with the dream team.
That's fantastic.
But we had audition. We there was like 40 of us. We were playing homeless people. It was a special episode, and there were like 40 of us auditioning. So it was cool because although we didn't meet them until we worked on the show, we got to be on the set and everything while we were auditioning, and it's fun for the actor, and I hope it was good for the director to see how we fit, but it was, I know it's different. I know that the world has changed since I did that stuff. Like you said, everybody does it by DVD and what do they call it, those little, the tapes, the M4s that they send in through their email?
Yeah, it's a whole new game now for auditioning. What it has allowed people to do, though, is, like, everyone doesn't have to live in L.A., you know, because you're putting stuff on tape anyways. And you can used to be always that actors would, I can't be there for the auditions. I'm not going to get the part because I'm shooting in Vancouver and they're casting in L.A., and now everyone can just send it in. So it does allow, you know, a broader choice of people in auditions, and you can see people that are doing other shows, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, but they still do the pilot week run, pilot time in January, right?
Yeah, where they're all auditioning. Still, end of January, end of February, and you know people flock to LA, but it's not as strong as it used to be. It used to be, you know, this intense little time period. The cable shows started to very smartly not do their pilots during pilot season, so that everyone wasn't competing for the same people. What used to happen was people wouldn't go in and audition for a certain show because they were up for another one or people were on hold. So now it's more spread out and it goes out throughout the year. The other cool thing that's happened in TV is that a lot of shows are doing like Dark Matter. You do a pilot, but it's already, you know, pre-sold enough that it rolls right into a series. So especially the cable shows, they just, and Amazon, you do a pilot and then start shooting the show right away, which is kind of cool.
And Netflix too, right?
And Netflix. Actually, Amazon actually does kind of do their traditional pilots, and then they put them on the air, and then they see what people think about them. And they say that's how they decide what they're going to choose. I'm not quite sure that's exactly how it works. But, TV is definitely changing that way. It's a fun new world to be in.
And what do you think of all the different things, the different changes for, like when you're auditioning actors and you're really basically just viewing them on your television or on the screen instead of actually having a conversation with them for a couple minutes before, does it make it harder?
I think it makes it harder. Here's the upside to it, is that some actors aren't the best at auditioning. You know, they're not the best when they're in the room. They're great when they're on set and stuff. So auditioning on tape, I guess the upside to it is it allows the actor to do a number of different, you know, takes, and then they send in the one that they like. So you actually get, I think, sometimes a stronger performance on tape than you would have gotten in the room. The downside is you don't get to meet them and kind of, you know, see who you're going to work with. But one of the funnest auditions I saw came in. I was doing the series The Strain, and we had a big guest role that was going to continue for a few episodes, so we really needed to know if the person was good. And the actor didn't have a reader with him and wanted to put it on tape, so he did it into his iPad, and he would act right into the iPad, but there was no one reading the opposite lines, so he just left them blank. What was really fun was we knew what the other lines were, and we could hear him thinking of hearing the other lines, and then he would respond. And it was kind of one of the coolest, most unique auditions, and we were like, oh, that's awesome. And we ended up booking him from it.
That's so clever. That is really clever.
It was so cool to just be like these blanks, and you see his brain listening to the other lines. And I guess he was probably reading them on the iPad, but kind of cool that you can now audition with your phone or your iPad. You don't have to have, you know, fancy lights and stuff to actually audition to be in the movies.
And it's like you could see it in their eyes that they were like listening to the other person.
Oh,
I always find that interesting.
Yeah, it was. I've told a lot of actors about this because I think it's actually was kind of a strong thing for him to do it. Even though it seems completely backward, but it was actually very cool.
That sounds like it's cool. Wow, really neat.
Have you seen seen The Strain at all?
The Strain?
The Strain?
No, I haven't seen it yet. What's it on? Is it on Sci-Fi?
It's on FX Network.
Oh, it's on FX.
Yeah.
I'm still trying to catch up to shows. Half of The Librarian, I haven't finished watching it, and the half of Turn, I haven't finished watching it. I'm trying to catch up because I was sick, so I haven't watched hardly anything.
There's so many good shows on television these days. It's fantastic. I love binge watching. I just binge from one show to another now. It's fantastic.
Yeah, and I like all different kinds of genres. So I DVR. I'm a DVR binger, and I watch an entire series sometimes just watching my DVR.
Yep, it's the way to do it.
But I want to see it. I do have it. I just haven't seen it yet.
It's good. Put that on your list. I've been watching Peaky Blinders is my new one that I tell people to watch. But, I love that show. Probably the worst title for a series. It's the worst title ever. Peaky Blinders. I've never heard of that one.
Peaky Blinders?
I'm going to keep telling people about it until everybody's seen it. Peaky as in like kind of peeking out.
Peaking. Okay.
Peaky.
And what's it about?
It's kind of a family in England in the 1890s that's becoming a mob family, but it's kind of the genesis of them becoming mobsters. And Cillian Murphy stars in it, Tom Hardy's in it, and it's just It's just one of the most beautiful shows on television. And if it had a better title, I'm sure people could find it. But it took me so many times to know what the title was.
It sounds
Sam
interesting.
Sam Neill's in it. Yeah, it's really
good. Wow. Sounds wonderful.
What is
my
on the list?
One of my new passions is Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries. Have you ever seen it?
No.
Oh, my God, it's such fun. It's set in the 1920s, and she's a bright, smart, independently wealthy, basically a woman who can do anything. She's like James Bond. She's sexually free. She has affairs left and right. It's like a man's part, what they used to call a man's part, but it's she's a strong woman. It's like my favorite show right now.
Oh, cool.
Very
I will put
kick-ass.
That on the
list. Do you know Essie Davis? She was in the Girl with the Pearl Earring, and she just did, how do you pronounce that movie? Badadoo? It's a horror movie. She was at the con with it and everything. But she's wonderful, and she's the lead.
Oh, cool. I'll definitely check that out.
I got an exchange. You gave me two, so I have to give you a couple.
Awesome.
We still have about 8 minutes. I wanted to ask you about your book. How's it doing? How much has it been raising money for breast cancer?
Yeah. The book, in case people don't know about it, is called In the Tub. And it's a coffee table book of photography that's portraits of actors, recording artists, models, all using a bathtub as a common setting. And all the profits from the book, or at least all my profits from it, go to breast cancer research. And the book's doing really well, and I'm deep into shooting Volume 2. I think I'm probably about, shot 140 people for Volume 2 of the book. And you can get it on Amazon. Go to Amazon, In the Tub. I also, on Flickr, I kind of post photos as I'm doing the shoot so that people can kind of track the book as it's coming together. And my Flickr site's, I think this weekend it's going to hit 26 million views. So there's
wow.
a lot of people following.
That's great.
I don't know. People like bathtubs. I don't know what it is. Might be the new celebs in the middle of them, but I'm not sure. It might just be the bathtubs.
I think it's the bathtub. Everybody likes white, you know, just the bathtub.
But it's a very fun book to shoot for me, and I get to meet, you know, really interesting people. In Volume 1 of In the Tub, I really shot my actor, recording artist, model, friends that I knew. But it kind of went through everybody by the time I was finished Volume 1. I shot 135 people. So Volume 2's friends of friends and people that get recommended and people that, you know, hear about it or write for the book will sometimes contact me. So it seems like almost every day I meet some new person and then do a quick photo shoot with them. So it's a fun project, and it's raising some money, so it's great.
It's a beautiful book. One of my passions, of course, is helping with breast cancer research. I think you're doing a phenomenal thing by doing it.
Thank you. The book's... If people don't know, the book's big. It's 17 inches by 11, and the special edition of it, which is the slightly more risque version, weighs 10 pounds. So it's a big-ass coffee table book. It's a very fun present for people, too.
And have a very sturdy coffee table.
Yes, yeah. It's kind of fun. A bunch of people have sent me photos of where they have the book displayed in their house, which is always fun to get. So I probably got about 30 people have sent me to photos going, this is where it sits. Which, you know, for someone who's done a book, that's kind of the coolest thing you can get. Seeing that it's actually out in the middle of someone's costume.
When I've gotten that, it's like somebody gives me them holding my book. It's like, yeah!
Yeah,
it's almost as good
fun?
As getting the first copy of your book.
I was scared getting the first copy. You always wonder if it, you know, how it's going to come out. Director, the always the scariest day of directing is actually getting the editor's cut of your episode, because then you see if everything that you shot actually makes sense and comes together well. And some days you're like, oh my gosh, this is great. Some days like, oh, we got work to do here to put this story so it's getting the book scary too, because once it's printed, it's printed.
Oh yeah. That's interesting, though, because when I was growing up, friends of the family were editors. We had a husband and wife editor family that were friends. And they said, one of the fun things is when it's all finished and you see your editor's copy. I never really thought about it from the director's point of view, like, oh, my God, it's the editor's copy. What did they do?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, when you shoot a TV show, you shoot so many different angles. There's an infinite, amount of ways that you can put something together. So you really rely on your editor to do the first cut, because you don't have that long as a director to go in to be able to retool the whole thing. So, but sometimes they just nail it and they put it together. There's one episode of Orphan Black I did that... I just looked at it and went, oh, I got no notes. Perfect. And it went on to win the Canadian Emmy for Best Edited Episode. So the editor just nailed it. It was the first, and I don't think they changed it from the first time she cut it together. It was just, bam, she just got it, and there it was.
That's why TV is called collaborative art, is because every single person who does, the writer, the actor, the director, the editor, the photographer, cinematographer, they're all artists, every one of you. I mean, it's amazing how you guys bring it together.
It's you can corral all those people in the same vision. It's awesome. I love it.
It's really beautiful. We're coming to the end. Believe it or not, 45 minutes whipped by, didn't it?
Wow, that was zinging past. Very, very fun talking with you.
It was great. Everybody see Dark Matter. It's going to be on Sci-Fi. The pilot has already been shown, but it's going to be in rerun. I looked mine up. I am going to be watching it this afternoon.
Awesome.
It's great, and I promise I'll see The Strain, TJ. I promise.
Excellent.
And thank you. Thank you very much for being on my show.
Thanks so much for having me as a guest on your show. It's always a pleasure. I'll talk to you later.
Thank you. And bye, thank Karen. You for chatting with Sherry. Bye-bye, TJ. Okay.